And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, our Wednesday edition. Well, this hour we visit with South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She was first elected to the Florida legislature in 1992. She served in the Florida Senate and is the first Jewish woman elected to Congress from Florida. She's been the chair of the Democratic National Committee since 2011. And we'll discuss her first book, a memoir, called For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. And the Congresswoman now joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be with you.
Welcome, and great to have you here. So the government shut down a near default on the debt, another round of the congressional deadlock that's becoming almost commonplace in Washington. Your feelings about that? And do you think we're in for another round of the same in a few months?
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, I hope that enough of my Republican colleagues, particularly the Tea Party-affiliated Republicans that drove us to this shutdown, have learned their lesson. And that is that, you know, in terms of the jeopardy that we placed our economy and the constant manufactured crisis-to-crisis governing that they have forced us into is really harmful. And that's part of why I actually wrote this book, because I hoped in part to really use it as an alarm, you know, as an alarm bell, you know, to sound the alarm for regular folks who might be frustrated about why we can't seem to really tackle our most vexing problems. Because the gridlock in Washington has just paralyzed us and left so many of these important issues on the back burner.
Now, your book, Next Generation, Congresswoman, kind of goes from the premise that we should govern as though we were looking, as though we were parents. And
yes.
You're described as a mom on a mission. Isn't that kind of kind of apple pie?
Well, you know, I started writing the book and thought about it about 3 years ago and realized, as I have for a long time, that all the decisions that I make and that, you know, every parent I know makes are made through the lens of being a parent. And those are both personal and professional decisions. And so it's really critical, I think, that if we're going to actually focus on how we can make life better for the next generation, which, you know, lots of politicians say over and over again. But, you know, is not an abstract concept for me. I mean, I've got the next generation in the back seat of my car and, you know, in the photos around my desk in Washington. And so it's very personal for me. And so I hoped in this book to be able to motivate people who read it to, you know, find the issue, whether it's education or healthcare or the economy or immigration reform or any one of the issues that we tackle in the book, that find the issue that really is the most important to them, and then give them a roadmap for how they can get involved themselves and make a difference in that issue.
Do you feel that politicians now are largely ignoring the next generation, or they're just, from you, as you said, going from crisis to crisis and ignoring the problems that are really pressing?
Yeah, I think we're not even able to get to the point where we're choosing to pay attention or ignore the problems that are the most significant to be addressed for the next generation, because we are in the midst of a constant state of gridlock. You know, if you look, that I tell a story in the book in the chapter on the economy about how just earlier this year in January, you know, we spent New Year's Eve in Washington because we were literally, you know, hours from going over the fiscal cliff, and yet another manufactured crisis because, unfortunately, the tail is being allowed to wag the dog in the Republican Party, and the Tea Party Republicans were willing to bring us to the brink of economic disaster again because they were trying to insist on reenacting all of the Bush tax cuts rather than deal with deficit reduction in a balanced way with targeted spending cuts and letting some of those tax cuts expire so that we could generate revenue towards deficit reduction as well.
Congresswoman, let's pretend we're just having a private conversation. Tell us a good story of the crisis during the government shutdown, and what it was like to be in Washington, and maybe something from behind the scenes that most people don't know.
Well, with the government shutdown most recently, the thing that kept coming up throughout the 16 days was the conversations that occurred between the women members. You saw some of that play out in the Senate with women senators being a pretty big part of how we brought this in for a landing and got the government reopened and avoided default. But the women House members who a number of us play on a bipartisan congressional women's softball team, and so we've built some trust and relationships across the aisle despite our differences on issues. And a number of us consistently said, you know, if they just put the women in a room for a few hours, we could get this whole thing sewn up, because women so often are really focused on consensus building and in getting to yes, trying to get to yes by not having the goal of obliterating your opposition and giving them and making sure that everyone feels like they got a piece of the final decision.
And what position do you play on the Congressional Women's Softball Team?
Well, I'm actually the Democratic co-captain on the House side, and I play second base.
Okay. So you're in the pivot.
Yes, and actually I was one of the founders of the game. We started it 5 years ago after I shared my own experience with breast cancer publicly and asked my women colleagues to start the game so we could raise money for the Young Survival Coalition and raise awareness about breast cancer in young women.
Well, I was going to quote John McCain from the Huffington Post, who said, "Leadership, I must fully admit, was provided primarily from women in the Senate after the bipartisan deal was announced." So I was going to ask you your thoughts on that, but I guess you've just given them. So,
but well, I mean, I think there's certainly more that can be said about it, because in the Senate, there are now a record number of women, 20 women, and they get together on the Senate side once a month for dinner and make it a priority to build those relationships so that there's trust there. And one of the things I talk about in For the Next Generation is that the demise of collegiality here. So many of my more senior colleagues and even retired members of Congress have attributed to the fact that we spend far less time in Washington than the years in which members brought their families up to D.C. when they were elected to Congress, and they were more likely to have their kids play on the same ball team or bump into each other in the supermarket or the restaurant, which made it harder to direct vitriol at someone whose kid played on your son or daughter's team. And there are just precious few opportunities for us to spend any time together outside of committee meetings across the aisle. And that's another benefit that we thought was important as women members, that there's a there's a congressional baseball team that's played for baseball game that's been played for 50 years, and the Republicans play against the Democrats. But of course, the women, we decided that when we started our game that we would play on the same team, Republicans mm-hmm. and Democrats together, and we play the common enemy, the female press corps.
Congresswoman, as a key congresswoman, is it that you have to be fundraising almost constantly, and how does that affect your performance?
I do spend a lot of time fundraising, when I'm working on my own reelection, and certainly as chair of the Democratic National Committee, I have some significant fundraising responsibilities. But professionally, my representation of my congressional district in South Florida is the most important professional responsibility I have, and I'm able to balance my need to do what I need to do to help my constituents hopefully want to have me remain as their representative, but at the same time do a good job doing the work that they elected me to do.
How do you balance your role as a congresswoman and your role as chair of the Democratic National Committee? Has that changed your congressional position in any way?
No, it really hasn't. As I said, my primary responsibility professionally is to be my constituents' member of Congress in the 23rd District in South Florida. And so, I sit on the Appropriations Committee and serve on two subcommittees there. One of them, I'm the ranking member of the Legislative Branch Appropriations Subcommittee, where previously I was chair I was a cardinal, as they say, in appropriations when we were in the majority. So that's where my legislative focus is. I also serve in the Democratic leadership as a chief deputy whip, and so I'm responsible in part for making sure that our members understand what our agenda is and the goals that we're trying to accomplish, and to get members to vote with us on the Democratic Party's top legislative priorities. And then, quite frankly, and this is, I tell a story about my process that I went through in figuring out how I would balance it all, because I want to make sure, obviously, my first priority in life is to be the best mom I can be to my children. And so that's my first job. And then balancing my professional responsibilities between the DNC and Congress are important, obviously. But when I looked at the calendar after the president asked me to chair the DNC 2.5 years ago, the Republican calendar is about the lightest in history. We really, at the most, are meeting 3.5 days a week, and that's with a recess every couple of weeks of a week. So the schedule was so light that it enabled me to, unfortunately, it doesn't allow us to get very much work done or address the needs that we have, and that's part of how all these issues have piled up, and we're really not making progress for our kids. But at the end of the day, I was able to, if you want something done, you give it to a busy woman, and I was able to make sure I could balance all those responsibilities and make sure that I did each of those jobs well.
We're speaking with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 9 years, and she's chair of the Democratic National Committee. The name of her book is For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. Stay with us on Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll return.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Congresswoman, you have three children, twins,
yes.
among them. You can afford private schools, but you've chosen public schools. What's behind that decision?
Well, I actually talk a little bit about our decision-making process and stress in the book and on the chapter on education, how important it is that each family make the choice that's right for them. We did have our kids in private school when they were smaller. We thought, there was a time before the class size amendment was put into the Florida Constitution that class size was just really out of control. And given that my job takes me out of town, I'm really, in the division of labor in our family, I'm the school parent. So I really thought it was important that class size and the attention that I thought my kids needed was paramount. So they were in school in private school and elementary school. And then a couple years after the class size amendment passed, because I went to public school, as did my husband, all the way through from kindergarten all the way to my master's degree, we moved them to public school and felt like actually that there was a much more significant variety of curriculum choices for them, and the diversity of the student body was important to us as well.
So your kids are in the Broward school system.
They are. All three of my kids are in public school.
We're speaking with... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, in Broward County, yes.
We're speaking with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. If you'd like to ask her a question or if you have a comment, the number's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. I'd like to talk about the cause of the shutdown, actually, the Affordable Care Act. In spite of all the technical glitches, which I guess we could get to, your views on it, especially as a breast cancer survivor.
My views on the Affordable Care Act?
Yes.
Well, the Affordable Care Act is something that was incredibly important to me. 21 years ago when I first ran for the Florida House of Representatives, I sat down and focused on the answer to the question, you know, Debbie, why are you running? And, you know, what do you hope to accomplish? And one of the key things consistently throughout my career, but especially at the beginning of it, was that I wanted to make sure that I could be a part of ensuring access to quality, affordable health care to all Americans. And we've achieved that with the Affordable Care Act, and I'm very proud of that. But I actually went through breast cancer, was diagnosed when I was 41 after a self-exam. Following my first mammogram after turning 40, which was a clean mammogram. So, you know, thankfully, I still paid enough attention to what was normal for me so that I knew when something felt different. And then was further diagnosed with the BRCA2 gene, meaning that I had a much higher likelihood of getting breast cancer and having a recurrence, as well as ovarian cancer. So throughout 2008, I had 7 surgeries. A double mastectomy, reconstructive surgery. I had my ovaries removed, and it was, life-altering surgery, obviously. But thankfully, because I paid close attention to my health, I was able to, and had good coverage, I was able to come through, and I'll be around to torture my children, as I tell them, for a very long time. But, the Affordable Care Act was very personal for me. It was something that, because I heard so many stories and knew that I was able to get the health care I needed right away without hesitation because I had good coverage, I've heard so many stories from countless women since I shared my own experience who had to choose between the chemo or the radiation because they were underinsured and couldn't afford the copay and the deductible on both. Or they found a lump but didn't have insurance coverage and couldn't get themselves to the doctor and ultimately were diagnosed at a much later stage and either hadn't survived or were at stage 4 when they could have been diagnosed at stage 1. So the 150 million Americans that live in this country with a pre-existing condition, on January 1st, Bonnie, will have the peace of mind knowing that an insurance company can never again drop us or deny us coverage for that pre-existing condition. And what the Republicans who voted for shutdown and held our economy hostage with the Affordable Care Act as ransom, what they were trying to do was take away that peace of mind that we know is just weeks away. And it's unacceptable. And I will fight to my last breath to make sure that that peace of mind is something that is enshrined in the law and that that no one can take that away from us again.
Now, what about, not to belabor it, but the overwhelming problems with signing up for the insurance? Why were they not prepared for what they knew was coming?
Well, there's no one that is more concerned than President Obama over the kinks and glitches that that have arisen through the implementation of the website. And there is a tech surge of experts that is triaging those problems and will be bringing the website into a state where it's going to be, and actually already is, far easier for folks to get online and compare coverage. But look, the analogy that I've used is with Republicans who are using this as an opportunity to say, see, the Obamacare is a disaster and we should delay it or repeal it, they were never for and won't ever be for making sure that everybody has access to quality, affordable health care. And so suggesting that we should just delay or even repeal the Affordable Care Act because there have been problems with the website is like saying that we should, because you experienced some problems with your kitchen redesign, that you decided to burn your house down. I mean, nobody would do that. You'd be much more likely to rip your cabinet knobs, change out your cabinet knobs or your countertops. Mm-hmm. And that's what the kind of work we need to do to get the website up and running effectively.
Let's take a few listener calls, Congresswoman, if you are okay with that. George.
Yes, absolutely.
George in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Three questions. First of all,
let's start with one.
Okay. If the Congresswoman sees the government as a parent. Wouldn't you agree that sometimes a parent cannot just give and give and give? It seems like what's going on now is that we're just giving away everything and there's no reining in. And then also, if Obamacare is great, why isn't Congress part of it?
Well, Congress is part of it. So just to answer that question right off the bat, you know, the Fox News talking points are completely incorrect. Congress required ourselves to get our insurance coverage from the exchange. So that right there, you need to understand is the accurate factual information. But I think you might have misunderstood what I was saying, because I didn't say I see government as a parent. I said I see, I look at and make decisions about policy and approach policy through the lens of being a parent, not that government is the should serve the role as a parent. And when you look through that lens as a parent, then you know it's important that we get the best possible high-quality public education system that we can, so that our kids can succeed in what is now absolutely a globally competitive economy. When it comes to making sure that we can deal with our environmental challenges, recognizing that global warming and climate change is real, and fighting against the climate deniers who continue to insist that global warming is a natural occurrence. That really is beside the point, although all the overwhelming science is there to show that the warming is man-made. We need to invest in making sure that we reduce our carbon footprint so that, particularly in South Florida, with the sea level rise that we've experienced, which is significant, that ultimately we are not harming our economy, and we're all one day living in Central Florida because there's no more coastline.
Congresswoman, let's take one more question from George.
Sure.
Go ahead, George. Oops.
Okay.
He fell off.
Jay, okay, I don't know the name, wants to know if you think that Florida will change its mind about the Medicaid expansion once the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented.
You know, sadly, it's not looking that way. Until Governor Scott actually decides to lead and put his money where his mouth is and push the legislature to actually go along with what he supposedly has said he agrees to accept the Medicaid expansion funds, then no. It doesn't appear that Will Weatherford, the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, has had any movement in that direction at all. And you know, what we just recently learned is there's 700,000 Floridians who don't have insurance coverage who would be eligible for that Medicaid expansion, mm-hmm. even though the federal government would pay 100% of the costs over the next 3 years and then 97% of the costs every year after that. The Republican legislature and Governor Scott have decided that it's okay to leave those folks uninsured and have them continue to use the emergency rooms that we all pay for in higher health care costs as their primary access point for health care. It's totally irresponsible.
And we do have to take a break now. We have lots of calls, lots of emails. We're speaking with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and the name of her book is entitled For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I think we've lost the Congresswoman. Perhaps you can take care of that. Well, Congressman, are you still on the line? I don't think so. Okay, there we go. Well, we'll be getting her back on the line in just a few moments. In fact, I wanted to ask Congressman Bonnie to talk a little politics and get her views on the midterm elections that are coming up in both Florida and nationally. And mm-hmm. I wonder what role Charlie Crist will play And what other strong Democratic candidates that we might have ahead of us? I'm sure she has some good views on
that.
Yeah,
we have some emails about that as well.
What's some of the email that you have there?
Yeah. Well, let's see. I don't know if she can hear me, though.
Well, we're getting her back on. But
Mary wants to know if she supports campaign finance reform. She's of the belief that if members did not have to spend so much time raising funds and then being beholden to those who finance them, members could take a longer range view of what's best for the whole country, not just a few donors.
You know, historically, campaign finance reform has been very ineffective, is that there's always loopholes and ways to get around that the dollar is still what makes things run. So it'll be interesting to hear what she has to say.
Right, that and about lobbyists and the influence of lobbyists in Congress.
Let's see, we have, we'll take Bert. Even, well, we're getting the Congresswoman back on, but Bert, we'll chat with you. Bert in Miami, hi.
I'm right here. How are you, sir?
Very good. How are you?
Good. I'm a Cuban-born U.S. citizen.
Hang on.
Go ahead.
Bert, let me just interrupt you while we get the congressman.
Thank you.
Congresswoman back. Oops, I'm sorry. I lost Bert. Bert, call back in, and I'll put you right on. Let's go to Mark in Miami, and Bert, call us back, and we'll put you right up.
Hello?
Mark, you're on the line.
Hi, how are you?
And Congresswoman, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
Hi, my name is
thanks
Mark.
Thanks to our technical crew here. Go ahead, Mark.
Quick question about race. When you're dealing with the right wing, extreme right wing, and members of the Tea Party, do you suspect race has something to do with their hatred of Obama? What's your sense when you're in Washington about that? Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
You know, I've seen Tea Partiers that are affiliated, you know, members of Congress, just focused on doing everything they can to block President Obama's agenda, to refuse to accept the reality of his initial election and then re-election, including the legitimacy of his election. Far too many of them won't even publicly acknowledge that they think President Obama is a legitimate president. But at the end of the day, regardless of whatever their motivation is, they're willing to harm the economy so that they can do everything they can to block him and to stop us from making progress and moving our economy forward. And, you know, when I go home to South Florida, you know, this is my 21st year in public office, and I talk about this, and it's what I hope readers take away from, one of the things I hope readers take away from the book is that, you know, even though obviously I'm a Democrat, I support my party's agenda, I'm the leader of my national party, but I know that it can't be my way or the highway. I know that, you know, in 21 years in office, I've been in the minority in the state at the state level and at the federal level for 13 of those 21 years. And, you know, in order to be able to be effective, I've had to reach across the aisle, learn how to, you know, make sure that I can build relationships and build trust with, among Republicans. We're not going to agree on everything, but, you know, we can't constantly go from manufactured crisis to manufactured crisis and dig in so hard to our position that we're not able to make progress on issues. And that's what the alarm bell is that I'm trying to sound in for the next generation, is that, you know, we are hurting our kids by stalling on all these major issues. We've got crumbling infrastructure. There's a whole chapter on, you know, what we're doing with in ignoring the backlog of crumbling infrastructure that we have in this country, to say nothing of the fact that if we invest in improving that infrastructure, we can create jobs and kick our economic recovery into higher gear. But yet, you know, the folks on the other side of the aisle who are allowing the Tea Party to drive their agenda are really making it so that it's impossible for us to move forward.
And we return now to Bert. Bert, I apologize. I accidentally kicked you off, so go ahead.
Yes, this comment or question is for Debbie. My name is Mr. Avila. I'm a Cuban-born U.S. citizen, and I'd like to ask Mrs. Schultz, why should I have to subsidize unhealthy people? And when you have an insurance program that charges premium based on income, not on health, isn't that anything but just socialized medicine, ma'am?
Well, you're okay. I mean, I don't know why you think you're subsidizing unhealthy people now, because we have in Florida 3.8 million people who don't have insurance coverage, and it
right. But you're not forcing me to get insurance the other way. You are forcing me. That's the difference.
Well, you pay for their coverage now because they show up at the emergency room to get their health care, and that's the most expensive way to get health care. And as a result, hospitals and health care costs.
But I haven't used a health care system ever.
Sir,
I've never been to a hospital.
I hear your question. Please let me answer it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So what we're doing now is you are already paying much higher health care costs because we're having to cover the deficit that exists when people who don't have insurance go to the hospital and use the emergency room as their primary access point. In order to make sure that we can continue to kick our economy into higher gear and make sure that one of the most significant drivers of our of what's kept us back economically, very high healthcare costs, lowering those healthcare costs for everyone is incredibly important for us to make sure that we can continue to move our economy forward. Right. To say nothing of the fact that healthcare should be a right, not a privilege in this country.
Well, I'm from Cuba, and their healthcare is forced upon people, and it's horrible. The right is to work hard and to earn a fair living. Nobody gives me a dollar. I work for it, ma'am.
Well,
How can you call that a right?
Cuba has a nationalized healthcare system, and the United States healthcare system has been and will remain a private market system.
But you're forcing people to buy health insurance, ma'am, that is nothing private about that. You're forcing the IRS wants to collect that.
Well,
you are entitled to your opinion, but I'm not going to debate you on this program.
Okay, Bert, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Take care.
We appreciate it.
Okay, Mary wants to know if you support campaign finance reform. She says she's of the belief that if members did not have to spend so much time raising funds and being beholden to those who finance them, members could take a longer range view of what's best for the whole country and not just a few donors.
I couldn't agree with her more. It is a very big problem that there is so much money in politics and that so much time has to be spent by people who run for office raising the money that they need. And so if we had campaign finance reform, and, you know, this was even made worse by the Citizens United decision handed down by the Supreme Court, where we added an infusion of, you know, a massive infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars by opaque, non-transparent, unaccountable corporate donations that are drowning campaigns in money. And essentially coming in and trying to buy elections.
But Congresswoman, hasn't historically campaign finance reform been highly ineffective? Is it? It seems where there's a will, there's a way to channel money, and you can get around through loopholes and find ways to channel money to candidates.
Well, I mean, it's been challenging. It's been challenging to deal with balancing between how you allow freedom of expression through the First Amendment, and that's, you know, what in part the Citizens United decision was, and you have a Supreme Court decision that is about to be handed down as well that will hinge on whether or not people's free speech rights are being limited by the caps on the overall amount that they can give to political parties. So it's been challenging to balance that right versus the law. But, you know, it is important in order to make sure that we have a more level playing field. That's why I've supported public financing of campaigns, and we've had in Florida, voluntary limitations on what statewide candidates raise, and they're able to to get public financing so that you can limit that overall influence. But, you know, of course, those limits get completely busted when you have a candidate like Rick Scott, who spends $70 million of his own money, and so campaign finance reform goes out the window. And then on top of that, in the last legislative session, supports increasing the amount of donations to $3,000 and allowing slush funds to be for every legislator to have a slush fund that they can raise unlimited cash into. That's going in the wrong direction.
What you call slush funds are what, PACs? Or?
State candidates now, as of November 1st, will be able to raise unlimited amounts of corporate donations into political, what is called political committees, that are separate and apart from their own campaigns.
But slush fund. But slush fund is your term.
Slush fund is definitely my term. Okay. I think it would be any person who supports making sure that we reduce the influence of money in politics. I think it'd be their term as well.
We need to take a break, but how much power do lobbyists have for you personally when you're deciding on an issue?
Well, the term lobbyist, I think, applies to anyone who advocates for a particular position, and I talk about that in the book as well. I hope when people read For the Next Generation that they all become lobbyists, that they find the issue that is the most important to them, and that they use the book as a roadmap to get involved in making a difference on that issue. And we give them a list of organizations and how to contact them at the end of the book so that it's right there in front of them, and they can jump right on it and be lobbyists on the issue that matters to them the most.
We're speaking with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and her book is For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. We'll be right back after a short break.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Congresswoman, you wouldn't mind talking a little bit of politics with us, would you?
Oh, always a pleasure.
Well, look ahead at midterms, both in Florida and nationally, and what is your view on the governor's race when it occurs? And where will Charlie Crist fit in? Sorry for so many questions.
No, it's okay. I think that there's a good reason that Rick Scott is one of the lowest two governors in the country in terms of approval rating. He's earned every bit of being at the bottom of approval ratings for governors nationwide because he has been really an obstacle to progress. He has been nothing short of mean-spirited. He's cut education and then, you know, gone back and tried to increase it. He's cut health care. He's really just been someone who has thrown obstacles in the path of so many Floridians who simply want to make a better life for themselves, yet he thinks that we can cut our way to prosperity like so many Tea Partiers do. And, you know, he's someone who has not led our state in the direction that we should go. And so
how about congressional races nationally?
Yeah, congressional races nationally. I mean, the Democrats have to win 17 seats to take the House majority back, and we're in the majority in the Senate. I think we're well positioned to do both things, especially now that the Republicans have brought us to the brink of economic disaster, and we're willing to default on our nation's debt and not pay the bills, you know, all in the name of stopping health care reform. I think that a lot of moderate, middle of the road Americans who simply want us to work together are fed up with them, and that's why the Republican Party is at its lowest approval rating since polling has been measuring it.
And let's go back to our calls. Let's see, Betsy, she's been waiting a long time. Thanks for your patience. Betsy in Miami, hi.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking my call. Congresswoman, I am totally in awe of you, and I, too, am a Cuban-born American proud Democrat. I would like to thank you for always helping women and children. And you talk about education and global, that we are now a global citizens. And I would like to also ask you about the Education for All Act and your support on that, being a good lobbyist myself. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It is so. When I say we're not all global citizens, we're clearly citizens of our own countries, but there's no question that when our kids graduate from high school and then choose the path that they wish to travel down in life, whether that's going to college or vocational school or out into the working world, that we need them to be prepared for that path. And it's absolutely essential that we move in the direction that President Obama has taken us through Race for the Top funding that has enabled us to shift away from the ridiculous No Child Left Behind requirements of high-stakes exams that are so high-stakes that it forces teachers to teach to the test and structure the curriculum almost exclusively based on what is students are being asked to spit back on those tests, and you know, making sure that young people have the opportunity to show what they know in a variety of ways and engage in some creative critical thinking. That's the shift that we're in the process of making by moving to the Common Core standards and knowing that our kids are going to be compared on a nationally norm reference test to peers across the country. And you know why Governor Scott, it's incredibly dismaying that Governor Scott now has responded to Tea Party complaints who, I mean, this is how irrational the Tea Party is and how we really need to just put their whole movement to rest here. The Tea Party is opposed to the Common Core standards because they think it's a federal takeover of the education system. I mean, nothing could be more ludicrous than that. What Common Core is it's going to make sure that we have standards that will in our education system that will allow our kids to make sure that they could finish school and be ready to be competitive in a global economy. We're not just competing when our kids graduate against American kids. We're competing for jobs, you know, with students from all over the world. And now Rick Scott is backpedaling, playing games, and trying to play footsie with the Tea Party because he's up for re-election. And it's another blow to our public school kids who simply need leadership in Tallahassee that are going to ensure that we can have the best prepared students in our public schools.
Congresswoman, we originally had you on mostly to talk about your book. And, of course, we've gotten into a lot of other issues as we must. And I certainly will say right now that our program, we welcome any Republican congressperson who wants to come on Topical Currents and take calls and discuss issues. You're more than welcome. Just contact us, and we'll do that. Let's take a quick phone call. Tony in Hollywood, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Hi. First, I'd like to thank Congressman Wasserman Schultz for all her hard work.
Welcome.
I had the opportunity to work with her in her early years here in Florida. And I guess just my frustration, and I'd like her reaction to it, is that the Dems constantly seem to allow the other side to set the message. And, for example, in the Obamacare, you know, we seem to be behind sort of explaining things after the fact to counter the negative tone that has solidly been set by the other side. For example, a few callers earlier, you know, socialized medicine. This, you know, I kind of wish it was. I have Medicare, and I'm quite happy with it. But it's private insurance with a few government rules.
Yes.
And how is it, again, that we never seem to get the message out? Our education, if you will, job is, I think, quite poor.
Well, primarily because the Republicans have always been focused on simplistic solutions to complex problems. And so that lends itself to, you know, overly simplified messaging. But you know, Tony, I would actually argue that that we've done a pretty good job as Democrats at making sure that there's a very clear understanding on the part of voters about the two directions and the two paths that they could choose from in the last election. That the Affordable Care Act and whether it would be implemented was one of the central questions of that election, and President Obama won overwhelmingly. And you know, he won in part because they understood that they wanted their leaders to fight for the middle class and working families, to focus on job creation, and to stop the endless gridlock and ideological rigid adherence to extremism that the Tea Party has been insisting on. And, you know, at the end of the day, one of the things that was important to me to stress in this book was that we really can and must work together, that we've got to look past, you know, hardened ideological positions. And, you know, look, I realize that the Affordable Care Act, as much as I support it, is going to encounter some problems. It's a big change. Anytime you have a big changes like that, you know, we're going to encounter problems. But rather than scrap the whole thing or suggest that we never should have actually passed it in the first place, we should work together, as we have in this country for more than 200 years, to overcome those problems and try to iron them out.
Well, we want to thank you, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for being with us today. She served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 9 years. Prior to that, she was in the Florida State Legislature. She's chair of the Democratic National Committee, a mother of three. And her book is For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems.
And, of course, we'll be having links to the book at both our Topical Currents Facebook page and also the WLRN.org website.
And
audio archives as well.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, Bonnie, thank you. And also, I want to apologize to those callers we couldn't get on the air.
And those emailers that we couldn't get to. We apologize.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we do have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also, author and book links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like so your friends can find us as well. And tomorrow's program begins with South Florida-based mega author and History Channel host Brad Meltzer. He's written a unique book with pull-out documents about 10 amazing mysteries. You can now actually hold a facsimile of a John Wilkes Booth wanted poster. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining tomorrow. And here's our calendar for October 23rd on this day in 1925, 88 years ago. The birth of talk host king Johnny Carson in Corning, Iowa. A year before his death in 2005, he appeared as a voice on The Simpsons. And on this day in 1942, 71 years ago, the birth of physician and author Michael Crichton in Chicago. His debut novel was The Andromeda Strain in 1970. And one more while we ponder the almost golden story. On this day in 1983, 30 years ago, NBC reporter and anchor Jessica Savage and New York Post Vice President Martin Fishbein die after he drives his car into a canal in Pennsylvania. We leave with a thought from Michael Crichton, quote, "To quit medicine to become a writer struck most people like quitting the Supreme Court to become a bail bondsman." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay with Public Radio. Next hour, it's Here and Now from NPR News.